Hi, this is Tess Vigeland, and you're listening to the Marketplace Money Podcast for the weekend of January 7th, 2011. If your New Year's resolution is to get your finances in shape, stay tuned. We'll have some simple ways to boost your bank balance this year. And we'll hear from this ambitious kid.
When you start this young, you've made an impact already at this age. If I can do that for the rest of my life, I will impact so many people. It'll be like great. It'll change the world.
It'll be like great. She and her friends are learning how to raise lots of money for charity. And here's an example of chicken littling about the rise of social media.
People are going to use Twitter and Facebook and they'll never leave their home again or have social interactions.
Critics said the same thing when the telephone was invented. We'll talk with an author who lives in the future and can tell us how it works. Those stories and more coming up. But first, if you have decided that 2011 is the year to get your financial house in order, you're in good company. A worldwide Reuters poll found 7 out of every 10 resolutions this new year involved money and the management thereof. The primary tool for launching those resolutions would be, of course, a budget. But there's one little problem. Budgets rarely work for the long haul. Tara Siegel-Bernard wrote about this recently in the New York Times. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So, like any good host of a personal finance show, I am supposed to say, everyone, set up a budget. You say,
don't. In many cases, you know, most people start out with the best of intentions, and we want to set up a budget. We want to turn over a new leaf with a new year. But what happens is it turns out oftentimes like dieting. We set up too many restrictions for ourselves and not enough fun. So we end up binging later, consuming more calories or overspending. So it's better to set up some kind of broad guidelines and, you know, just become more conscious of our spending.
Why is this so difficult for folks to follow through on? Is this one of those behavioral finance issues where our brains just don't work on budgets?
In part. If you think about it, part of the reason a lot of us spend too much is because we all whip out the credit card and there are no immediate consequences. There's immediate gratification, but no immediate consequences until you get the bill, you know, 28 or 30 days later. And research suggests that when you're actually paying with cash and watching that pile of cash diminish over the course of a day or a week or a month, it's actually more painful. So we're a little bit more mindful of our spending if we use cash as opposed to credit cards, debit cards.
Well, you know, one of the things that you talk about in your article is something called mental accounting, and that perhaps this would help folks more than actually sitting down and doing a spreadsheet budget. Tell us what that is and how that's different.
Sure. Well, mental accounting is when you divide your money into separate mental accounts that you treat differently. So think about, you know, if you get your paycheck every week, that's hard-earned money, and you're going to be more careful with it. But if you suddenly won the lotto or were given a gift, you might be more likely to spend that on, you know, fun items.
Right.
We tend to behave that way, so we can actually use it to our advantage. Say you have a, you know, your basic checking account or checking and savings that are linked. What you can do is set up sub-accounts. You know, if you have a budget of, say, $3,000 a month for your entire household spending, rent, mortgage, food, utilities, what you can do is then break off, say, $300 or $400 or whatever you can afford for fun money and put that into a sub-account.
But isn't that just a budget by another name?
It is. And in fact, it's all in the framing, really. Several financial planners don't use the word budgeting. You know, that's a dirty word. They prefer the more euphemistic spending plan because everybody wants to spend money, but nobody wants to, you know, budget and save. So
that's like just instead of dieting, you're just going to eat right.
Exactly.
So what's the best way, you know, if folks have decided, okay, one of my New Year's resolutions is I'm going to set up a budget, I'm going to stick to it. If we're saying that you may be setting yourself up for failure, what's a good first step for people to do outside of that?
Simplicity is key, and automating is key. You don't want to automate to the degree where you, you know, become unconscious of, you know, or just completely lose track of where your money is going and your cable bill is inflating over time like mine did at the end of the start of this year. Yeah. But what you want to do is start backwards. Figure out what sort of savings goals that you have, whether it's retirement, that vacation. Set up all of those savings goals and then work with what's left over. And then once you've kind of gotten a better feel for where your money is going, which is another thing, you also want to kind of keep track of where your money is going for at least a short period of time so you could identify, you know, problem spots. But then once you do identify those problem areas, just attack one or two of them. You know, maybe just say, oh, I'll spend a little bit less on going out to eat this month.
Okay. Excellent places to start for everyone. Tara Siegel-Bernard writes for the Your Money section of the New York Times, and we've been talking about her recent article, Why a Budget is Like a Diet, Ineffective. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And we have a link to Tara's story at marketplace.org/money. So you don't have to feel guilty about not making that budget. But if we're skipping that step, what else might you do to get yourself in money shape? Well, the blogosphere and Twitterverse had plenty to say about that this week. So we called up some of our favorite blogger tweeters and asked for their best nuggets.
My name is Steve Schoenle, and I write at BritBlatt.com. Everybody, no exceptions, needs to work on developing a side income. The reason people need to do this is because that in today's workplace, there are no guarantees about employment, and almost anybody can find some kind of freelance work that they're able to do. My second tip would be concentrate on getting healthy. A lot of people think of getting healthy as a resolution that they need to do because they want to be more fit or they want to look better, but I'd also argue it's a financial improvement that you can make. Even a minor illness can derail you from your job. It can make it more difficult to meet your obligations at work, which could cost you down the line in terms of promotions or even getting on the best projects at work.
My name is Kelly Whalen, and I am with WiseBread.com. I really recommend that you start off the new year by getting organized. And one easy way to do that is to get a free credit report. The website to get your free credit report is annualcreditreport.com. Because you get three free credit reports every year, you can set up a reminder in your calendar or in your phone so that in 4 months' time, you can come back again and do another free credit report. The last thing I would recommend is that you sit down and make a list of things that you've been putting off, whether that's going to be setting up a new bank account or opening that 529 account that you've been putting off. For me personally, it's going to be setting up a business savings account and opening an additional 529 account for my children.
My name is J.D. Roth, and I'm from GetRichSlowly.org. One thing that I think that a lot of people can do is to do regular reviews of their accounts, things like savings accounts, credit card accounts, but even utility bills or any place else that you pay money. If you can call up your cable company and say, hey, is there any kind of special promotion going on right now that I qualify, or is there anything I can do to get a discount? I think it's also important to take stock of the monthly expenses you've got right now. I know when I was getting out of debt, I had to take a look at my expenses and say, okay, am I really watching this deluxe cable package all the time? And the answer was no. And so I cut back to basic cable, and that saved me $50 a month. It added up, and it helped me get out of debt. And if you can identify little things like that in your life and cut those out, well, eventually you've cut enough to pay for something you really do want or value.
My name is David Welliver, and I'm the publisher of MoneyUnder30.com. Some common financial advice we hear is to have a yard sale to make a couple hundred dollars selling things that we no longer need. I think you can really take that a step further by reevaluating everything you own and go on a selling spree. You can find things that you don't need anymore, don't use anymore, don't really value anymore, and you can use that money to put towards debt to jumpstart your savings for the year. But you'll also realize the value of possessions that you once, you know, spent your hard-earned money for, but now may not value so much.
My name is Julia Scott, and I founded BargainBabe.com. A lot of folks are embracing the spend less, save more mantra. I say go for a no-spend month. I did it for 30 days, paid my rent, I paid my utilities, that kind of stuff. I bought groceries, but anything extra at all was just, I can't do it. And it really frees you up to think about If you can't spend, you're not worrying about, is this going to break my budget? It's just, okay, I have no money. What can I do for free? Strange as it may seem, a great way to save money right now is to go on vacation. The values are incredible. Airfares, hotels are extremely cheap. Some of the best cities, Atlanta, San Diego, Chicago, San Francisco, New York City. You go on vacation now, you're going to save a bundle over summertime prices.
And we've got links to all their blogs at marketplace.org/money. You can also follow them on Twitter. And me too. I'm at Radio Tess. A couple of years back, the Wall Street Journal had this great blog feature called What's in Your Wallet? No relation to the Capital One ad slogan. They went around asking regular and famous Joes and Janes to open up their wallets and tell stories about what's in them. Well, the Journal discontinued that blog and the wallet feature, so we are reincarnating it as a regular element on our show and website. This week, we stepped outside our Los Angeles studio to find out what's in your wallet.
Hands in my pocket, hands in my pocket, hands in my pockets.
Because of your giant wallet, just get rid of it. Never. It is a part of me.
Mike Maggio, I'm from Herndon, Virginia, and we are in front of the Walt Disney Music Center. There's a lot of junk. I carry a bunch of debit cards and a bunch of credit cards, probably about five. I don't use them all. Well, this one I use when I go to Costco, and this one I use most of the time, my Chase card, and that's it. And then I have my debit cards, which are actually my main cards. It's black leather, Calvin Klein, and it folds in three. This is for a carousel at the mall back in Virginia where I take my son every once in a while. Frequent flyer card. We haven't used it much lately. He's getting a little bit old for this. But, you know, you get a free... I think I'm due for a free ride soon. I don't have pictures of my family, which is a shame. It's got lots of coupons, receipts, and... inevitably, when I buy something, my wife wants me to return it, so I have to save the receipt. Otherwise, it gets lost.
Yeah, we have a video of his wallet on our website, and we will open another one next week. Meantime, if you want to know what's in mine, go to marketplace.org/money. It is that time in the show, once again, where we take your questions. And with me for this week is our economics editor, Chris Farrell. Hey, Chris.
Well, Happy New Year, Tess.
Happy New Year to you as well. I don't know about you, but I am not a multimillionaire this weekend, unfortunately.
You're not?
No.
Oh.
But I did play the lotto. Did you?
Well, Tess, here's the thing. Nothing against playing the lottery. I'd love to win the lottery. But you have to play the lottery to win. And I just don't do it. You really do.
Well, what do you think of this question of whether it's, you know, I've seen it called a tax on poor people. Somebody posted that on our Facebook page. You know, folks say it's a complete waste of money. But I don't know. I'm all for a little bit of fun.
I'm all for it's called the stock market for everybody else. OK, so we all like the idea of, you know, beating the odds and, you know, getting a windfall. So I don't really have a problem with it from that point of view. I do think, though, it's a tax on the poor.
All right. Well, I want to get your take on another subject that we've already addressed in the show, which is budgets. And we heard a little bit ago from Tara Siegel-Bernard at The New York Times, who had a story that basically said that budgets are ineffective. What's your thinking on this?
You know, the way I think of budgets is like a checklist. You sort of go through and you say, okay, I know I need to do this. I know I need to do that. Put that on my list. It just helps you focus, kind of concentrate on it.
But beyond a checklist, what about this notion that, you know, you got to have a spreadsheet for every expense, every ingoing, every outgoing piece of your money?
Here's the way that I look at budgets. If you automate your savings, it just happens. And then you just have some money automatically taken out of your checking account, going into your savings account, and you put away the credit card. Basically, what you're doing is you're saving the amount of money you want to be saving. Who cares where you spend the money? The only time you really want to care about what you're spending your money on might be at a major transition. You have a child or you're nearing retirement. Beyond a short period of time, you want to make this a habit.
All right. Well, let's hit the phones for our first calls of the new year. And David is with us from Alexandria, Virginia. Hi, David.
Hello, Chris and Tess. How are you doing?
Very well, thank you. Are you someone who does budgets?
Well, I do use Quicken, as a matter of fact, and I've been doing that, I guess, for quite a long time, actually.
So you are in Alexandria, Virginia. Let me take a wild guess. You work in government?
Actually, no. I am retired from the U.S. military. I was Air Force.
How long did you do that?
I was active duty for 24 years.
What are you doing now?
I'm enjoying my retirement, actually.
Yeah? What are you doing with it?
Well, I've been doing some traveling. I enjoy that. I guess last month I was in Hong Kong. Before that, I visited a friend in Germany, and I went on a couple of cruises, I guess, during the summer.
And where are you wanting to go that you haven't been yet?
Well, Hong Kong was actually, that was the first time I went there. And I have a very strange confession to make. That was maybe one step above just throwing a dart at a map. I was looking to get enough frequent flyer miles to get to the next elite level in my program. So you wanted to go
as far away as possible.
Well, the tickets to Sydney were a little too expensive. So Hong Kong had a very good price point. It gave me the miles that I needed.
Oh, but listen, this is so much. I know somebody who... Exact same position, and you fly to Alaska, and then you stay overnight at the airport hotel, and then you fly back. I think going to Hong Kong is a lot better.
Yeah, I was there for a few days since I hadn't been there before, but I have done the out and back thing before.
Really? Just to get the miles?
Just to get the miles, yeah.
Oh, man, I just can't imagine that. I hate flying.
Well, remember, I used to be in the Air Force.
Well, that's true.
And I am an aeronautical engineer.
All right, well, enough chit-chat. How can we help you out?
The original plan when I retired was to take some time off, maybe do a little traveling, and then go back to work. Mm-hmm. But after being retired for a little while, I guess I decided, well, I really like this being retired thing. And so and I have come to wonder what sort of consequences might be associated with being retired. Are there any opportunities for tax-deferred or even tax-free savings? Are there any options that I could take advantage of given my position?
Well, the classic place is tax-exempt bonds.
Okay.
Tax-exempt money market funds, tax-exempt notes.
Okay.
So that'd be the first thing. Now, I also have an idea for tax exemption if you do start earning some income, though.
Okay. I'd love to hear it.
Well, the other thing is you're not going to get an immediate tax benefit, but even if you're just working part-time, maybe we'll talk a little bit about that some more, but have a Roth IRA, because the big advantage of the Roth, after 5 years, the money you withdraw, any gain, is exempt from taxes, period.
Well, I do have a Roth right now. I just can't contribute to it.
So, but when you can contribute to it, that's where I'd be looking. You're not going to get the tax benefit today, but boy, you really will get a tax benefit tomorrow.
Okay. Now, I have another question. Are there any long-term consequences associated with choosing not to work for an extended period? I mean, obviously, it's going to affect my income, but are there any issues, for example, associated with Social Security? Is there going to be an effect on what ultimately I can get that from Social Security or Medicare?
Were you under Social Security while you were in the military?
Yes, I was.
The whole time?
Mm-hmm.
All right. So you're going to have a pretty good Social Security. I mean, you're pretty much covered there. The main price that you're going to pay, the longer that you're out of the workforce, people will hire you, but you're going to be less and less valuable because you're going to be out of it. You're not going to be keeping up with your skills.
Right.
The other advantage of doing some part-time work is really maintaining your network.
Ah, yes.
That's actually the most valuable aspect of why you would want to keep doing some kind of work. It's not that you can't restart it, but it's going to be hard.
I see.
And David, boy, I mean, I would think there would be just a ton of nonprofits and schools that could use your help.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Well, there's actually another aspect of this, too, that when I was approaching the retirement, that for most of my life, it was pretty much programmed. I mean, you go to school, you get a degree, and of course, I was in the ROTC. So, of course, I knew I was going to go into the military. When I retired, this is really my first opportunity to decide to try something new. Do I want to go back to work? Do I want to take time off? Do I want to travel? Or do I want to go back to school and maybe study art history or something along those lines? And I guess with the advantages associated with the new GI Bill, I mean, education is certainly something that I could try to investigate.
Yeah,
absolutely. Oh. And go into something just entirely different that sparks a passion for you.
I mean, art history might not necessarily be as lucrative, but if it's something
I'd vote for that.
I would enjoy.
That's a luxury that that a lot of people would love to have. And boy, take advantage of it.
That makes sense.
All right, David. Great question. And let us know what you decide to do. I'll be curious.
I'll definitely do that.
All right. Thanks so much for the call.
Thanks very much.
All right. Next up, we have Mason from, St. Paul, Minnesota. Hi, Mason.
Hi, Tess.
So are you and Chris best buds?
Yeah, we're really tight.
I knew it.
He's available 24/7 for financial advice.
Tess, there are more than 100 people in the town of St. Paul, Minnesota.
Well, yes, but you're all like the friendliest people in the world, so how can you not know each other?
Well, Chris, I have met you like once. Can't remember.
I was that memorable, huh?
Well, no, but I mean, it might have even been at some sort of gathering.
All right. Well, I go to lots of gatherings, and I'm sorry I don't remember you, but...
No. There would be no reason. I don't think that we even really talked very much. I refrained from spilling my entire financial history to you.
You're the only person that has, has refrained.
That's because I'd only had one martini and not two martinis.
Yeah. Chris goes to a party and people corner him with like, well, I have this 401k and...
I really can't remember if it was like at a fundraising event. I'm in the arts, so that is very much the realm that I find myself in at times.
Oh, that's interesting that you're in the art field. We were just talking to a former Air Force officer who's thinking about going back to school to study art history. So what do you do?
What I'm doing pretty much full-time for about 25 years is I'm a critic, a writer-critic. I write about the visual arts, architecture, and design.
That sounds amazing.
For local publications as well as national publications.
So you get paid to see beautiful things, or sometimes not so beautiful.
Right.
So what can we help you out with today?
Well, my question is that I have a lot of credit cards.
How many?
Okay. I have...
Uh-oh.
Including department store credit cards, I have 16.
Dope!
Okay. You may have won the lottery on this one.
Okay, well, excuse the art joke, but how did you manage to acquire such a collection?
Okay, so some of these go way back. Starting more than a decade ago, as all these credit cards were very available and, you know, things were coming to the house on a daily basis.
Yeah, a lot of people did that.
I use only two of them, really.
Why not just cut up the rest of them?
So this is my question. If I cut up or cancel most of these credit card accounts, is that going to impact my credit score?
Okay.
Chris, this is a very common question that we've been getting, particularly over the last 2 years. And so they want to cut it up, but they're worried about the credit score. Your take on this? It seems to me like we're worrying too much about the credit score.
Yeah. With real estate, there's that expression, you know, location, location, location.
Correct.
For me, when it comes to unused credit cards, it's cancel, cancel, cancel. Now, it is true that it may have an impact on your credit score.
But not much of one, right, Chris?
It's not much of one. But here's the real thing. What really matters is your credit paying history. So if you're paying your bills on time, you'll take a little bit of a hit. It disappears relatively quickly. So the only time you would hesitate, if you're going to be out buying a house within the next 3 months, I would say don't cancel them. But let's put, you know, a big, huge poster on your refrigerator that says, bought house, signed for mortgage, cancel credit cards. In today's world, it is not to your benefit to have unused extra credit cards around, period.
I totally agree. I just, you know, especially for the peace of mind, if you don't need it and you're probably going to start paying fees on credit cards that you're not using because you're not using them in some cases, you know, it's just not worth having them around. And even if it dings your credit score a little bit for a little while, it's going to come back up.
That's fine. And the other thing just to throw in there is I have a position of there's no reason for anyone to have more than two.
Yeah.
Some people have said three, and one is your personal credit card. One is your business credit card. Some people who travel a lot have said that they would like to have a third credit card for emergency purposes. And that's fine. But that's, you know, the maximum that I can come up for most people is three credit cards. And that's including if you have a business like you do.
Okay.
So does that help you out, Mason?
Yes, it does.
Terrific.
It helps me out quite a bit.
Great.
Terrific. Well, thanks so much for the call.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Bye-bye. Well, Chris, a couple of really interesting questions there, but I think you and I are on the same page that...
We're on the same page on this.
You know, just get rid of those extra cards. You're going to be paying money just to have them in your wallet or sitting in a drawer somewhere. It's not worth it.
Right. It's just not worth it. And I don't want to harp on identity theft because the odds are your identity is not going to be stolen. But
It's definitely part of it.
It's part of the risk that's out there. But again, there's something about you're managing your money in the interests of the credit card companies, not in your financial interests. That's why I always rebel against this notion that some people have, never cancel a card because it's going to impact your credit score. Yep. I'm going, no, this is your money. Let's organize it in your benefit, not the credit card company's benefit.
Amen. If you've got a question, let us know about it. Our voicemail is 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. Or send us an email through the Getting Personal link at marketplace.org. Chris, thanks so much. It's been fun.
Thanks a lot, Tess.
And do remember to talk to your own financial professional before making any big money decisions. Got your Thin Mints yet? Samoas, maybe? It is Girl Scout cookie time. And thank you very much. I'm hungry now. But the cookies really are all about fundraising, right? One of the classics in kid philanthropy. But these days, young people are getting more involved in higher-end charity decisions. They're sitting on foundation boards and allocating grant money to nonprofits, April Demboski reports.
Teens are involved in all variety of extracurricular activities, football, glee club, chess. But this group of 22 San Francisco high schoolers gathers on Sundays to learn about strategic grant making.
Hey guys.
Leading the meeting is 16-year-old Leah Tabernick.
The first thing that we'll have to do is find nonprofit agencies to fund this year. So everyone has to do their bit of research.
Tabernick and other teens then do a skit to show the group how they're going to get nonprofits to apply for money.
We just raised $6 million and we don't have anyone to give it to because we didn't get any grant proposals. What are we going to do? Ugh!
Da-da-da! Behold, I am Super RFP. I am a request for a proposal. I bring nonprofits to you.
Help me. I need money to buy school supplies for needy children in Africa.
Now help me. I need money to free children from sweatshops in Asia.
This year's group decided to focus on drinking water issues in Southeast Asia. The effort is part of a six-month course sponsored by the Jewish Community Federation, a Bay Area organization that donates to causes around the world. It started the teen program in 2004 to teach young people not just how to write a check, but how to get the most out of every charitable dollar. Galad Salmon oversees the program.
We ask teens and young adults to be civically engaged, and we talk to them about voting, and we talk to them about volunteering. But very seldomly do we talk to them about incorporating philanthropy into that as well.
With the so-called millennial generation coming of age, the program caters to a cohort of web-savvy youth that know all about humanitarian issues around the globe.
This generation have often been called net natives or digital natives. They're, you know, one click to the rest of the world, and they can research organizations and different issues no matter where they are.
Last year, teens in the program raised $177,000 and split the money among 25 nonprofit organizations. This growing participation by teens in philanthropy has charitable groups taking notice, especially in recent years as donations have plummeted.
The economic situation has caused all nonprofits to look at all types of revenue diversification.
Paulette Maihara is the president of the Association for Fundraising Professionals. It's an international umbrella group with 30,000 members.
And the youth market is clearly a very large market for potential donors and potential volunteers.
Maihara's group wants to tap into that market too. The association has rolled out a new fundraising curriculum at schools in five different states. One of these schools is Tortolita Middle School in Tucson, Arizona. Eighth grade teacher Kathleen Neighbors incorporates the philanthropy curriculum into her English class.
What is the difference between selling things just to raise some money and actually trying to solicit money for a cause that we've identified?
So instead of writing papers about Catcher in the Rye, students like 14-year-old Destiny Bennett are learning to write requests for grant proposals.
When you're writing a request for a proposal, you see, oh, wow, this really does make a difference. But if you're just writing it on an old book, it's just more schoolwork that I have to turn in.
With the lessons they've learned, Bennett and her classmates plan to raise money making and selling salsa to the school community. They expect to bring in $1,500, and the students debated giving it to a homeless shelter or an animal rights group, but settled on addiction services for youth.
students in my school have been like secretly doing drugs, but just to make them stop because it can ruin their life forever.
Organizers of the philanthropy courses in Arizona and California hope that they can show young people that they don't have to wait until they're retired or wealthy to start giving.
It's great when you can like get involved when you're 30 or something.
That's Bay Area 15-year-old Sarah Moses.
But when you start this young, you've made an impact already at this age. If I can do that for the rest of my life, I will impact so many people. It'll be like great. It'll change the world.
The philanthropy course has had an impact on Moses, too. She's now considering a career in the field. I'm April Dymbosky for Marketplace Money.
Figuring out how to manage your own money is hard enough, so imagine trying to teach it to young people. The demand for personal finance in the classroom is growing, but according to a recent survey by the National Endowment for Financial Education, teachers are less than enthused about teaching it. Why? Because they don't know it either. Ted Beck is president and CEO of the NEFE. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Really, the upshot of this survey seems to be that teachers across the country agree that there is not enough financial education going on for our kids, yet they are not terribly comfortable doing that education themselves.
Well, they're dealing with a couple of trends, and this is really why we sponsored the survey. We were concerned that there was a great building interest in financial education in the country, part of it recession-based, part of it the idea that kids have to get back to some basics. So we invited a whole bunch of schools of education in 2006 and said, eventually this might end up on your plate. And to the extent that that's happened, let's study where we are, because we had been hearing anecdotally from teachers for years where they are teaching basic finance, they're a chapter ahead of the kids. 89% of the teachers said that kids should get this as part of their educational process with an emphasis on high school. But we do not feel prepared to actually do that classwork. 60% said they felt they weren't comfortable in their ability to actually teach the standards that states were starting to adopt.
So what does that tell us, then, about the state of financial education for our kids?
Well, I think it tells us we have some work to do. Now, before we talk about strictly what can be done in schools, there's some interesting research we actually did through the University of Arizona and said, who is demonstrating really pretty positive, knowledgeable behavior here? And what were the factors that caused that? And there were three. First of all, family. The family talked about money. They showed them the basics. They worked with them on allowances and balancing checkbooks and all the things that you would hope would be discussed in the home. The second was education, having that foundation course. And the third was having had a part-time job. So, you know, we were fairly encouraged by the educational component of that, but I would hate to sell short the parental involvement. We really think that's very key.
When you say that there are studies going on of how you can have more effective communication of personal finance knowledge, do you have any results of that yet? Any clues that we have for how to get kids both interested in money and knowledgeable about it?
A key part of it is interactive learning. We learn more effectively, especially as adults, by actually taking actions. I mean, one of the pet peeves I have about traditional financial education is it's kind of like sex education, is that when you're actually willing to talk about it, you tend to talk about way too much. And so, you know, if we could get somebody interested in financial education, we'd sit them down and try to teach them everything from this is how a paycheck works to, okay, now you're in retirement. And at a certain stage, your eyes glass over. So trying to do it at appropriate times throughout your economic life rather than just one sit down, I think has been a very key trend in our community.
For the folks in the listening audience who are perhaps parents, educators, dealing with kids and wanting them to have this education, how can they go about doing that?
Well, there's a couple of things. Talk to your kids about money. And if you're not sure what to talk about, do a little homework. You know, if you've lost a job or if you have reduction in hours, you got to talk to the family about it. If you think the kids don't notice, guess again. I moved from the East Coast to the West Coast about 25 years ago, and I was on an earlier schedule. And I was used to getting home 7, 8, 9 at night. And I moved to California where the market was different. And I got home for dinner. My children proceeded to have a little parade in to talk to my wife after about 2 months saying, and this is when there was an economic slowdown going on. They said, is Dad okay? And she said, what are you talking about? I said, well, he's home for dinner. Did he lose his job? And she laughed and said no. But the thing is they had noticed a change in the pattern, and they hear the news, and they were concerned that we were hiding something from them. So it's an example of if you're open about things and talk to kids about it, they'll get through it. They're resilient.
Ted Beck is the president and CEO of the National Endowment for Financial Education, and we've been talking about how to get those kids educated with their finances. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
It's hard to argue against the need for more financial literacy, but commentator Ira Reingold says you'd best consider the source when you hear that education is a cure-all for our economic woes.
As a longtime consumer advocate, I place my hand over my wallet when someone from the banking industry suggests better financial education will help solve most of the problems in our consumer financial services marketplace. It's not that we don't need financial education in our schools or that both children and adults need to learn about debt and credit. It's simply that after years of working in consumer protection, financial education can never replace tough, fair regulations that reward banks for serving consumers, not exploiting them. Over the last two decades, we have all seen a fundamental shift in the way consumer banks make most of their money. Long gone are the days of George Bailey's Building and Loan, where your corner bank thrived when you successfully placed your hard-earned savings in its care, or when you made your monthly mortgage payment on time. In those days, when you missed that payment, your community bank was likely to contact and work with you before your financial troubles grew. Today, we have a banking industry that thrives on consumer failure. Its bottom line depends on persuading us to borrow more than we know we can afford, to write checks and use debit cards when we know or don't know we have insufficient funds in our accounts. Overdraft fees, bounce protection, payday, title and refund anticipation loans, late fees, overlimit fees, balance transfer fees, yield spread premiums, credit life insurance. These are all designed by banks so they can profit when we don't use our money wisely. Financial education and financial literacy programs are great, but we're kidding ourselves if we think they'll have any real effect on our ability to save or to use credit properly. That won't really happen until we create rules and regulations that stop banks from tricking and trapping us into products we don't need and we can't afford.
Ira Reingold is executive director of the National Association of Consumer Advocates. We want your thoughts. Post them on our Facebook page or go to marketplace.org/money. The American consumer has a lot to deal with this year, unemployment, foreclosure. But at least we know the dollar is and will remain our currency. Not so for the former Soviet Republic of Estonia, which converted to the euro on January 1st. We wondered what it's like to swap out a currency everyone knows and loves for a strange new one. Christopher Worth has the story.
Nine a.m. on a weekday morning, and some two dozen students are crammed into this neat modern classroom in central Tallinn. Today's lesson focuses on exchanging Estonia's old currency, the krone, for its new one, the euro. As a student reads aloud from a worksheet about the changeover, she stumbles over a word. Jagatud, she asks. The teacher writes the word on the board. Jagatud, or in English, divide. These students and everyone else in Estonia will now have to divide the old price of things by 15 to get a rough estimate of their cost in euros. To be precise, it takes 15.646 krones, the old currency, to make 1 euro. Natalia Fedosova and her family are trying to figure out what it will mean for them.
I feel that a bad time is coming, and I don't know what to expect.
Fedosova fears the switch in currencies will lower the value of her paycheck. And to calm those fears, the Estonian government handed out calculators designed to convert krones to euros so that everyone will know exactly what they're getting. As she sets the table for dinner, Fedosova plugs in her monthly salary of 10,000 krones, or about $800.
And it is, just let me see, 639 euros. You see, it is not enough.
This is what economists call the money illusion, a phenomenon also noticed in other European countries that have adopted the euro. It's where the amounts used in the old currency, in this case 10,000 krones, are compared to the numbers in the new currency, just 600 euros. And because the new number is so much smaller, people feel like they're earning less.
It sounds strange, you see?
People are also concerned the change to the euro means higher prices. Businesses are more likely to round prices up than down. As her daughter plucks at the piano after dinner, Natalia Fedosova uses the calculator again to convert the price she pays for a bus ticket, 10 krones.
And it is 64 cents.
She says she thinks the cost of the ticket will just be rounded up to an even 1 euro, which would be an increase of over 50%. And she fears similar price hikes at stores like this Maxima supermarket, where staffers have been busy changing price tags. Erki Aralade is the company's spokesman.
So the big sign going to be in euros, and the little one is krone.
The government in Estonia hopes to get stores like this to put a sign in the window showing they've agreed not to round prices up. But no matter how much is done to reassure shoppers, Morris Lori, an economist at Swedbank, says Estonia's switch to the euro could initially be bad for consumer spending.
People maybe will not spend as much because they will sort of calculate everything.
That is, until the effect of the money illusion wears off. By then, she says, people will realize that joining the eurozone was good for Estonia. But back at the supermarket, company spokesman Aralade holds a 100-krone note in front of him and says he's going to miss the old currency.
It's more beautiful than the euro.
For many Estonians, the krone is a symbol of the country's hard-won independence. It was only introduced about 2 decades ago, after Estonia broke away from the Soviet Union.
At that time, I was young and rebellious, and it was a very, very interesting time.
So you're going to be sad to see them go?
I don't know. Sad is not the right word, I think. But, of course, I'm not going to change everything.
You're going to keep them?
Yes, of course. Look and put, oh, okay, nostalgic.
He squeezes the 100-krone note up to his chest like a treasured old friend and says he's going to hold on to a few of them for the memories. In Tallinn, I'm Christopher Wirth for Marketplace Money.
Where would we be without technology? Well, if you're a cynic, you might say, a lot better off. What with all that Twittering, Facebooking, texting business? But author Nick Bilton has a new book that might usher you into this century. It's called I Live in the Future, and here's how it works. We spoke about it recently before a live audience at the Drucker Business Forum. He began our conversation by telling me about a story that appeared in Wired magazine a couple of years ago, an article that claimed that he, a New York Times writer, didn't read the actual paper.
I remember the day that I found out that I could actually get the Sunday paper on Saturday. So I would ride my bike every Saturday morning to the New York Times. And all of a sudden, I just stopped going, and I stopped reading the print paper. And what had happened is I started to replace it with a social experience, with my phone and all these other experiences. And after a while, I ended up canceling my subscription. And so when the Wired reporter approached me at this conference, and he asked me, do you read the print paper? It was almost like time stood still. It was like that moment in The Matrix. And I was like, how do I answer this? And I was honest, and I said, no, but I read it on my computer, on my laptop. And so the article on Wired said, Nick Bilton loves the news, it's newspapers he can't stand, which was a little bit editorialized. But when I got back to New York, my bosses went berserk. And my response was, at first, I was very apologetic for what I'd said. But then after a while, I kept saying, well, I'm the next generation of consumer for the New York Times. If I'm not reading the print experience, maybe you should be asking what I'm doing instead, and we should be focusing on that.
You address this issue of whether all this technology is dumbing us down. Mm-hmm. And that long-term content, like books, like newspapers, will die.
That's not what I say.
No, yes. No, not at all. Yeah. And in fact, you counter that by saying that kids will play video games for 3 hours at a time. How is that not long-form content? But Nick, it's video games.
Yes, but video games are a narrative, right? There was a friend of mine who went to Europe this summer. He took his son, and he was really excited that they were going to France, and they were going to Normandy, and he was going to tell him all about the war and what happened. And they get to the beach, and his son's like, oh, this is where the British came over, and this is where the Germans were. And he described this entire thing. He kind of, like, acted it out. And he's like, how the hell do you know this? And he's like, oh, Call of Duty 2. So my argument in the book is, in a history class, why do we all have to go in and open up this book and plod through this really kind of mundane experience?
Plodding through a history book.
Who took history class and had this book that it was like, oh my God, I got to go to history class again, right? Why can't that be an immersive experience where you're involved in that world?
You tell some really great stories about the history of technological advance and how a lot of the fear and doubt that you're hearing now about Facebook and Twitter has happened historically in many, many ways, from the printing press to the telephone to television. And people have what you call technochondria.
Yes.
Yeah. Technology hypochondria.
with the printing press, there was tremendous fears, especially in Venetian society where a lot of the stuff was taking place, that the printing press would kind of destroy society. This was one technology after another that happened. And happened with the telephone. The front page article, March 22nd, 1876 on the New York Times, it describes what this technology is, but then the writer says it's going to empty concert halls and churches and people will never leave their home again. The same thing we're hearing about the internet, right? People are going to use Twitter and Facebook and they'll never leave their home again or have social interactions. And I think it's just another in the line of communications and technologies that we're a little bit afraid of, which is kind of understandable, but we should recognize that we've been here before.
I want to ask you to respond to a quote from Jerome Lanier, who wrote a manifesto recently called You Are Not a Gadget. He basically comes out and says that Facebook reduces life to a database.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it is and it isn't. It's, you know, I mean, there's 500 million people on that service. But one of the misconceptions is that these things are going to replace real life. And I don't think that that's the case. It's interesting. When I was researching the book, I found when the printing press came out, it didn't change society instantly like we think that the printing press did. It wasn't until the 1500s when a gentleman by the name of Aldus Manutius invented the mobile book. Before that, books were 50, 100 pounds a piece. Like, it took like two people to turn a page. And the mobile book really changed everything because you could take it with you. And I think the same things happen with mobile phones. You know, for a long time, computers were the way that we access content, and we sat in our bedroom or our office and we didn't leave. And people don't want to do that. They want to be out. And these mobile devices that we all carry around, I think, have become that, essentially the mobile book of today.
I don't know if any of you have actually seen the book yet, but when you go through the book, at the beginning of each chapter, there's a little symbol here. And if you've got a mobile phone, you download an app, and you click on it, and then you click on this. I hope you can hear it. So now what it's done is it's taken me to a website where I can get more information on all the material that's in this chapter. I can engage in a conversation with readers of the book. It's really, really cool, I have to tell you. I've spent some time doing this over the last couple of days.
One of the things that I write about in the book is that I don't think we sell content. If I said to you, I'm going to sell you this book on Post-it notes, would you buy it? No, because the experience would be awful, but the content is there, right? So I'm not just selling the content, I'm selling the entire experience. There's the hardcover, there's the design, there's the layout. There's this entire experience that we pay for when we think we're paying for content. This is something that applies not just to media, but to every single thing we do. You're not just buying the car, you're buying the thing that goes around that, and especially it takes place with content online when it comes to newspapers and books and magazines and things like that, and radio shows.
That was Nick Bilton, New York Times technology writer and author of I Live in the Future and Here Is How It Works. We spoke at the Drucker Business Forum. We've got links to his book and the extended interview at marketplace.org/money. And that is Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, with jobs still scarce, how much can you really focus on finding a job you want instead of just taking a job you need?
It's not ridiculous to want to move forward and reach self-actualization, because there's plenty of studies to prove that that's when people are most satisfied, they're most happy, they do their best work, they're their best people.
We'll explore what's happening to the purpose-driven career. Marketplace Money is produced by Deborah Clark with Devin Robbins and Stephen Hoffman. Our technical director is Josh Rogerson. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. I'm Tess Vigeland. We'll see you next week.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org, or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the subscribe to podcast link and never miss an episode again. Marketplace Money is supported by Putnam Investments, offering new ways for investors to pursue their goals with lower volatility. On the web at putnam.com/absolute return.
American Public Media.